I'm first going to make a few points about the nature of macroeconomic thinking that is gender blind. And of course, if something is gender blind, that means it is actually gender biased. Right? It is gender biased. It is choosing not to see gender. So it is gender biased. It is not just sort of innocent blindness. It is also bias, and it leads to the kinds of consequences about an unjust world economy that we live in. So blindness leads to bias, which leads to injustice. Okay. So gender-blind macroeconomics, whatever variety it is, actually treats labor as a non-produced, quote-unquote, factor of production, right? Factor of production. And it's assumed like, you know, children grow on the trees and then you pluck this and they turn into laborers. And of course, Rania talked about that at length yesterday. This kind of economics treats households as merely consumption units. So in your sort of typical, you know, macroeconomic models, you will have the household, HH, and what do they do? You know, it's like C plus I plus G. C, consumption, and the sort of the people, the corresponding institution, if you will, to this is the household, which is the provides the demand for consumption. Okay, ignores unpaid domestic care work that we have been talking about a lot. That's the idea of, you know, children coming from the tree. Ignores gender division of labor. And one of the things that we have been talking about is that there are very strong gender-based division of labor in societies, both in terms of the primary division of labor that we see between production and reproduction work, paid and unpaid work, but also even when we look at paid work or labor markets, we know that there are strong patterns of segregation and segmentation. Women tend to be doing more, concentrated into much fewer sectors and occupations in the paid economy, and the, whereas men are spread throughout the economy much more evenly, if you will, as workers. Women tend to do the kinds of work that resemble unpaid care work. And this kind of work gets also consistently and persistently undervalued in labor markets. So the kinds of jobs, occupations, and sectors that are associated with women also are undervalued socially and within the market sphere. In fact, the other thing that we also know is that women, even when they do the same type of job or similar kinds of jobs, get paid lower compensation in labor markets. So there are many, and these are related to each other. When segmentation is related to segregation, is related to compensation, and social undervaluation of skills that go into the kind of work that resembles the sort of work that we do as caring labor under conditions of unpaid work in the household or in the community, they always get also undercompensated, unrecognized. There is a social undervaluation of this kind of work. So the typical kinds of examples is that women tend to be more, for example, primary school teachers or child care workers and so on. And of course, they are the value of their work is unrecognized, whereas the value of the work of someone who is a plumber in the United States, the wage of a plumber is very high. The wage of a child care worker is very, very low. One is done by women, the other one is done by men. And these patterns can be reversed or change over time. So it's not that they are fixed or the same everywhere. But people think that, you know, leaving your house in the hands of a plumber to fix the plumbing is apparently more important than leaving your child with another human being. And when the plumber, you know, does something wrong, it's a big mess. But when a child care worker does something wrong, this is the life of a child, and this is the life of your child. And somehow, people do not prioritize. The plumbing work comes more recognized than the child care work. So we live in a world that is really, really what? It is unfair, and it is also crazy. The priorities are crazy. Social priorities are crazy. I'm sorry?
And rational, because every economic system all over the world does not calculate values. In the middle of any economic system on the planet is profit, not a human. That's why.
Exactly. It is because economies, and in fact, this is the point that we're going to make now in our macroeconomics. How do we visualize the macroeconomics? Economics is for people, and in the middle that we have to put the human life of people. But right now we live in economic systems where this has not been the case. And this is why we live in a crazy world. This is why we have to set the world straight. As economists, as gemistas, that's what we're doing. All right. Ignores gender division of labor, ignores inequalities within households, ignores behavioral differences. So when we take the household, we say, well, this is a unit of consumption, you know. And of course, a lot of analysis are carried on using the household as the unit of analysis. So it is assumed that within the household, distribution of consumption is, and expenditures are also equal, nice, and fair. Household, the concept of the household is associated a little bit with the concept of the family. Families, of course, have all this warmth, love, and so on and so forth. Well, of course, there's a lot of violence as well in households and families, and there's a lot of not only cooperation and sharing, but there is also a lot of conflict, contention, inequalities, and exercising of power. Exercising of power. So power relations permeate the household. They also permeate markets. They permeate all kinds of institutions. Right? So the inequalities within households are ignored. And of course, one of the things that we have focused on with Femmes Equanimes is to show that there are inequalities in households between what girl children get and what boy children get in terms of education, health care. This may not be so in every society and culture and so on, but we do have these kinds of broad patterns. Usually in many societies, mothers eat last. If you go to villages, you will see, no, not in middle-class houses, but if you go to villages, mothers eat last, they first feed everybody. A lot of times it's first men, adult, able-bodied, working men, and children, and then the women. So we can talk about this as women and children last. Practices of women and children last. And women do this themselves. It is not because somebody putting at that moment a gun in their head. They are socialized to do this, right? So, anyhow, and there are differences in economic behavior, as we have been talking about. Rania has been talking about that, right? Not everybody behaves the same. As it turns out, men tend to be taking higher risks, for example, in economic behavior. They tend to do more risky kinds of things compared to women. women tend to be more risk averse. It goes through a number of channels that it would include also investments, what women do with their pension funds versus men, what the men do with their pension funds, and so on and so forth. So that's just one example of behavior in behavioral differences. So it would be interesting to ask the question, well, what kind of world financial system would we have if women were dominating that system? Maybe they would also behave like men. We don't know that the answer to that question, but it's a question that must be posed. We also know, for example, was from something that we call the good mother thesis, which we talk about in a number of ways, and we shall see that it has a macroeconomic relevance as well. These might be seen as the differences at the microeconomic level, but they all carry themselves throughout and permeate the macro economy as well. What is the good mother thesis? The good mother thesis refers to the finding that across a wide variety of cultures and controlling for class position of people, income levels, and so on, women tend to spend a higher proportion of their own income or the income they control, the money they control, on children and things that benefit children at the present and also in the future, because these are things like nutrition, of course, food, healthcare, education, right? But education is something, it also means that in economic terms, you're also we're also seeing that women are better investors if you see education as an investment, right? But of course, they might do it just for the well-being of their children, but as it turns out, it also happens to be an investment in the future of the economy, because if you're increasing the capabilities of children, then this will reflect in perhaps the potential for a higher growth rate in the economy. And what do men do? Because they actually get the world's majority of world's income is controlled by men, right? Women have a much smaller share of the income in the world economy. Women have a much smaller share of assets in the world economy. But with whatever they have, they actually put it in. They use it more. What's that? What? I didn't hear that. Can you repeat that? Por favor. And they say that we went hiking in Appalachia. Yes. They go see their girlfriend in Appalachia. I mean, Argentina, and all kinds of other things, alcohol, cars, and so on. And whenever I mention this in any setting, and I mentioned this last year in Turkey in a presentation, and they had actually, the colleagues there, economists, they had done this research and said, oh, yes, this is true in Turkey, too. We exactly found this. Of course, men want to play with their toy. And these were male colleagues. And they said, we did this research. This turns out to be true in Turkey, too. And it cuts across classes. So for the higher upper classes, let's say higher income people, the men might be buying very expensive cars, you know, multiple expensive cars and so on and so forth. But also for those who are poorer, there might be other things. So they spend more of their money on things that give them gratification. It's not clear that these things actually add to their capabilities. Sometimes they subtract from their capabilities, because that's also one of the ways in which men tend to get and spread HIV, AIDS, as you know, to the rest of the population. This is because this is part of their fun, loving activity. Those who can't afford to go to Argentina, they do other things that are similar to going Argentina. And in the process, actually, they may be not only I guess create immediate gratification for themselves, but they can also be creating or contracting diseases and do all kinds of things that are not only harmful to them, but like they can also do things that are harmful to their wives and children. And this is one of the ways, of course, in which HIV AIDS has spread so fast. In the United States, people used to think this is a this is an illness of homosexual people and so on and so forth, but absolutely it is not. But this is one of the ways. So you know, these kinds of consumption patterns have their many, many consequences in terms of health, well-being for children, for the rest of the family, these differences. Now what is the implication of the good mother thesis? If you just sit there and you are just thinking about this, and you know the stylized fact that women tend to spend a higher portion of their income on things that benefit their children, and men do something different, you also know there are two things you know, and you also know that the distribution of income in the world economy is very much skewed against women, because actually when we look at the world economy and when we combine paid plus unpaid work of women and compare that to paid plus unpaid work of men, who does the work? Who does most of the work in the world economy? Once we recognize the unpaid part of it as well, it is women. Who doesn't get half, even half the income? That's why I was saying yesterday, you know, a lot of countries, women's wages should be higher. They are actually higher educational attainment. So in the world economy, if we were living in a fair and just world, women, and if people got paid according to the hours of work they did, then women should be earning more, controlling more income, and should therefore be accumulating also more assets than men. So what does this situation look like, ladies and gentlemen? What does it look like? What does this world look like? It looks very crazy. So we have to turn things upside down. And what would actually, you know, there is this famous China from China. Anything that has associated with China will be said in reference to you, because you are the representative Chinese. I am very sorry. I am saying that in a joke. Nobody is representative of anything. Okay, unless they want to be. You know this thing, women hold up half the sky? Who said that? Huh? Chairman Mao Zedong. He said that women hold up half the sky, and he was sort of saying it, why he was saying it to emphasize that women hold up half the sky, that they are equal with men. Well, I have news for you, Chairman Mao, they hold up more than half the sky. It's not, you are wrong, they do not hold up half the sky, they hold up more than half the sky. So we will all sort of try to remember the saying of Mao, just to remember that it is women who do most of the work in this world and do not get even half the income. But if they did, so these are two stylized facts that we know, right? The good mother thesis, women spend more than blah, 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 on their children, et cetera, et cetera. The second thing is women do not control half the income. And third thing is, from a justice point of view, our instincts would tell us, not only as economists, but if you ask any person, if you explain these two things, economist, non-economist, whatever, the instinct will be to say, well, this is unfair, and therefore women should be, actually, there should be a distribution of income and assets toward women, on the basis of justice, because they do more work than men. And secondly, but there is another consequence of this, what would happen if that actually happened, that we did distribute income toward women for the purpose of being just and fair, but also what would be another consequence of this? Who would benefit from this besides women? Children would benefit from this. This would increase children's well-being. And in fact, in that case, it would be the well-being of both boys and girls, right? So it's not a straight case of we're taking money from men and giving it to women, because we are thinking about this in terms of the reproduction of human beings. And the people who will be reproduced in a much healthier state will also be the male children as well. So it's not a straight distribution from men to women. But from a growth accumulation kind of perspective, given the kinds of things that we were talking about, What would you speculate? If you did this kind of distribution or redistribution, just intuitively, before actually we talk about formal modeling, I just want to give an example that gives us the intuitive of this. So suppose the question that we have at hand is growth and accumulation, you know, as that we talked about. Theme of economics is about value distribution and growth and so on. All right, so what kind of implications might that have on the rate of accumulation, on the future? It has well-being implications, right? At present and currently, but what about the future? It would be likely to lead to a higher rate of accumulation because the more, in general, okay, there are many reasons why these things don't occur, but in general, it is likely that if you have a population with a higher capabilities, I am not saying human capital, I'm saying capabilities. And if you are in my classes and you say human capital, then I immediately say capabilities, okay? And there's a reason why I do that. But in general, if the population is better educated, better fed, nutrition, and has better health, then more skills and so on, and you are likely to have a higher growth rate. But we also know that there are many countries in which the people are highly skilled, have education, health, and so on and so forth, and this does not necessarily lead to higher growth rates because there are all kinds of institutions and policies and so on that work against that. So, but in general, I'm just saying, in general, we are likely to have a higher growth rate. In fact, many, many studies show that people who have better nutrition have higher productivity in agricultural work, for example. This is very important. A lot of studies show that. Okay, my sister, Rania, had her hand up. Would you like to come in? Well, would you like to just, okay, all right. Okay, claro, sí, Latinas, and there are no Latino Latinas. I am practicing my Spanish, you should be encouraging me. Yes, claro, yes, sí, yes, okay, gracias, we move on. My Chinese doesn't. My Chinese doesn't go that far. Okay. Allah, Allah. Huh, okay. Did I skip? Okay, yes. All right. Okay, so for some reason, it skipped a couple. Okay. So, when we bring bringing gender or feminist concerns into macroeconomics, what we do is we start with these sort of visions of the macroeconomy, bearing in mind what gender-blind macroeconomists, the kinds of assumptions that they make, which turns them into gender bias in macroeconomic thinking and in economic thinking in general. So we start with a sort of a vision of the macroeconomy, and then we do actually models of the macroeconomy to show, to carry out the implications, to trace through, to think through the implications of the visions that we have of the macroeconomy. And then we hopefully, the reason, the purpose that we are doing modeling is, of course, to lead to come up with policy interventions that are gender aware, gender equitable, but that are equitable in general, right? Not only to women and so on, but also class-wise equity, etc. Macroeconomic policy, but also to gender aware macroeconomic politics. And you know, every time I say policy, you can think of it as policy/politics. Because without politics, there is no policy, and that means that we may not be in a position to actually advise or do formulate policy ourselves, but we have to be involved in the politics of that. So this is why it is so important. Okay, so the question is, though, when we're doing modeling, for example, what kind of macro models should we bring gender into? So we talked a lot yesterday about the differences between orthodox economics and heterodox paradigms. So the question is, will any model do? I mean, do I take something by orthodox economist, neoclassical economist, neoliberal model, and so on, and say, if I put a little bit of agenda here, your model is going to be gender aware. No, that will not happen. What you will end up is, you will end up with a oxymoron. Okay, not every time you see some variable that says G, gender, women, da 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 da, this doesn't mean that it is a gender sensitive, gender equitable, or even, this doesn't mean that you have fixed the problem by just inserting a variable somewhere. Okay? You gotta put the variable in the relevant and appropriate context. Okay, so if you start with a macroeconomic a thinking that just arrives at the macroeconomy, but just summing all the individuals in the economy, right? We have a representative individual, and then we just add these people from, I 1 to whatever 200 million, and then boom, we have the macroeconomic, the macroeconomy. And then you put a gender, little g, something, whatever. That will not work, because that is that model and that conception is problematic to begin with. Not only because it is lacking in gender and gender blind, it is just blind in general. And there is nothing wrong with being blind. By the way, when I say blind, I don't mean to be offensive to persons with impairments in vision and so on. I am just saying this is something that people choose to be blind. There is a difference between intellectual blindness and choosing to be blind and being militantly blind. So I'm talking about intellectual blindness. So there, everything is wrong with this model. And in Turkish, we would say, we have a saying that would, in a sort of folksy Turkish way of saying it, would be, I have to translate it. I'm going to say first in Turkish, we'll say deveye boynun eğri demişler, nerem doğru ki demiş, which means, translates as, folks said to the, talked to the camel and told the camel, your neck is crooked, and the camel responded, is there anything that is not crooked about me? That is the, so we have the camel. Crooked camel approach to criticizing macroeconomics. Earlier we had the Mao approach to recognizing women's labor, and we modified Mao by saying women hold up more than half the sky, and now we have the sort of the camel critique of orthodox macroeconomics. So anyway, okay. So we cannot just sort of put a little g someplace in any kind of model that is off the off of 14th Street, as I used to say when I taught at the New School. We have to do not only gender and macroeconomics, but we have to do gender and heterodox macroeconomics, because these kinds of paradigms, heterodox paradigms, as I said before, we were discussing yesterday. Yes, this will be a little bit long, because I actually have a lot of ground to go through. Do I have 30 minutes or 30 minutes, yeah, to go? Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord, can we get... Okay, because I've actually condensed a lot of things into this presentation. Gender and heterodox macroeconomics for the kinds of reasons that we discussed today. And the heterodox economics, we can say that the whole is always greater than the sum of the parts. Again, I'm trying to sort of do these statements without... Okay, now... let's just go back to a sort of way of conceptualizing the macroeconomy. In general, macroeconomy is conceptualized, yes. Yasin-san.
Because that goes back to the notion of rights, that goes back to what, I mean, really, you know, we are referring to as a legal instrument, and also what we mean by, you know, the equality between women and men and fighting justice. So instead of saying macroeconomics and gender in macroeconomics, why don't we say gender equality in macroeconomics?
You are right. It is not just about, you know, somehow gender disaggregating men and women. You will see that I am at this point, I am using it as a kind of a shorthand. I would actually not even just use the word gender. That's why I've, you know, be using the word feminist in the way that what it means to me, because I'm not talking about just gender equality. We are talking about all kinds of equality, so the more precise way of talking about it would be either feminist or humanist, and you will see in the slide, because we're talking about all kinds of equality and equity, but I am just using gender now as a shorthand, so every time you see gender, please bear in mind that it is exactly along the lines of what Yasin said, but also the whole spirit of what we are doing is to bring about, achieve social justice and equity and dignified life for everyone. And it's not just in terms of also the money we get, but it's about dignity and rights and that we have. But thank you very much for reminding that again. Okay, now, if we do, when we do macroeconomic modeling and macroeconomic analysis, we as economists, what do? We take a few selected markets and then we trace the interactions between these markets, right? It might be the labor market, the capital markets, and then the markets in goods and services. But so we can think about it as finance, you know, asset markets, production, and also reproduction generally comes in the form of labor market, right? There isn't a kind of a broad notion of reproduction. What we really do is finance, production, and labor markets. And we look at the interactions of these markets, and then we ask some kind of macroeconomic question, and then we answer that question by tracing the interactions between sort of aggregate kinds of markets. Here I put reproduction because from where we are coming from, we are talking about a broader notion of reproduction that entails not only what is happening in the labor market and so on, but actually outside what I called the circuit of capital, as would be discussed in the sense of Marx. Okay? But usually it is finance, production, and reproduction. And then you look at the interactions, and boom, you come up with a model. Now, however, going back again to some of the discussions that we had yesterday, as you know, prior to the Washington consensus, there was something called a Keynesian consensus, right? And that's the golden age of economics. What is that? Rania, you were saying something. Oh, you agree? Oh, okay. Thank you, Rania-san. Thank you for agreeing. Yes, of course. Of course, we agree on this. So there was a Keynesian consensus, and in the Keynesian era, which is also called the golden age of capitalism, where we actually, when we look at the growth rates of the world economy, right, in this period, that has been also called as specified as a golden age of capitalism. We see that actually growth rates were very, very high. in this period, in the post-war period, post-World War II period, until sort of 1980, we see that a lot of countries had growth rates that were, there was much less volatility, first of all, in the world economy, and even when you disaggregated economies into different groups, and the growth rates on average were higher for the world economy. And that's why it's called the golden age of capitalism. And if we take the break point between the Keynesian consensus and the Washington consensus as sort of 1980, but actually Washington consensus was brewing, much prior to that in the 70s as well. And then we look at the sort of the growth rates of the world economy in various countries, regions, and so on and so forth, we see that they are on average, what we see, there are two things. One is we see much higher volatility and volatility in consumption. And also, we see much lower, on average, much lower growth rates in the world economy. And in fact, for some decades, we used to talk about the lost decade of development, for example. As the 1980s, we used to talk about the lost decade of development. There were some recoveries, but a lot of times growth patterns, when we looked at the record of growth at that time, we would see what we would call stop-and-go growth cycles, and that was very typical, for example, in Latin America, that you have stop and go, and so on. And some places you had very long periods of very low growth rates and stagnation and so on. So a very good article that we should refer to is an article by Branko Milanović that came out in World Development, and that is called Against Globalization as We Know It, Two Faces of Globalization, Against Globalization as We Know It. And this is, of course, in the readings, and I think it's a World Development article that came out in 2004, is it? 2004. Branko Milanović, who used to work at the World Bank for many years, and for a variety of reasons, a lot of good people ended up leaving the World Bank. This is a very wonderful article. It is written very passionately. The language is very passionate. Please, por favor, please read this article. Okay, if you haven't already, por favor, just rush and read it. Okay, it's great. It's great. Okay, now in the Keynesian consensus era, the kinds of policy making, of course, was to emphasize the role of the state and the responsibility of the state. I am not going through this because most people are familiar, Keynesian versus Washington. Washington consensus is the era of neoliberalism where you actually try to minimize the role of the state in terms of policy. Keynesian consensus is very different. I am not going to go through the many different elements of this, but in many of our writings that we have on the reading list, you will see this kind of discussion with the differences and so on. But one of the things that was interesting about the Keynesian consensus is that in Keynesian consensus, production was actually seen to be primary to production of commodities, like you want to industrialize, you want to produce things, you want to have a high growth rate, and so on and so forth. But the role of finance was not primary. It is a kind of a thinking that in policymaking that puts production in a place that is prior to finance, and also prior to human reproduction. But human reproduction is taken care of in many different ways, for example, through the institution of the social protection systems, through institution of what we call automatic stabilizers. Fiscal policy is not pro-cyclical, but counter-cyclical. So in that sense, when there is a slump, the stabilizers kick in, and human beings are taken care of. In other words, human beings who become unemployed and so on are nonetheless taken care of through social protection systems and unemployment insurance and so on and so forth. So there is recognition of the importance of reproduction, but production is primary reproduction. And then the financial sphere, the sphere of finance, is seen as something that is assisting production. When we go to the Washington Consensus, what happened in the Washington Consensus era and in general in neoliberalism was that finance became primary and took a priority over production, activities of production, and this is the crisis that we see today. This is exactly why we have the kinds of crisis that we see today, and of course Jan talked about it, everybody else has been talking about it. Finance and concerns of finance and interests of financial asset holders became primary in the world economy. Right, and interest, because when we say finance, it's just not, you know, the bank, the building itself. It is really the protection of the interest of people who are holders of financial assets. So most policy was subjected to that, was subjected to the constraint of making sure that the value of the assets would be preserved and would actually multiply. And this is exactly why we had what we call deflationary bias. That's something that James talked about yesterday, and we're going to come back to deflationary bias. Deflationary bias is associated with the power relations of protecting the value of the assets of wealth holders. Okay? In other words, if there is a high inflation, then what is going to happen? The value of the assets are going to go down. So to make sure that the value of the assets do not go down, you go and err on the deflation side. You don't want inflation. That's why you don't want inflation, even very low rates of inflation, right? So this deflationary bias has a class bias to it, okay? But even within the sort of the capitalist class, there's a bias toward holders of financial assets, okay? So finance becomes primary, production secondary. And reproduction is really something that goes out the door. It is not even there as much as it was in the Keynesian consensus era, right? Why? First of all, macroeconomic policies become not counter-cyclical, but they become pro-cyclical. This has to do with the interest of the asset holders, wealth holders, okay? So for that reason, macroeconomic policies actually become not counter-cyclical but pro-cyclical. What does that do to human reproduction? That makes people even worse. We have, that is why we have also higher volatility in the world economy, both in terms of growth rates but also in terms of consumption patterns. And this is actually also was found out by the, we had been, so many of us have been saying, our colleagues like Ajit Singh and many others had been saying this for a long time, but also IMF researchers documented that themselves in a 2004 paper, that also paper is has as a co-author Ayhan Kose and others, that is also in your reading. So reproduction became completely just, you know, incidental. Of course, you need people to be around because you can't exploit them if they, you know, it's like you can't kill all of them. I mean, they got to be around. The workers have to be around. So you have to tolerate some amount of reproduction. But then, you know, there are always sort of somehow people around. So you do not care about reproduction. That's why social production systems got dismantled in the economies of the North, in the economies of the South. Anyway, you didn't really, in many cases, you didn't have any much of a reproduction system. So what we are proposing as feminist slash humanist slash heterodox economists, and I use all these three words, and every time I say feminist or gender aware, please have all these words in mind and choose the one that you like better. What we would have would be a different vision. I don't dare call it consensus, so that's why I put consensus question mark. But what we would do is we would have, first of all, reproduction of human life be primary, the primary goal, and then it would be production, and then it would be finance. And I put this finance a little bit, I even wrote it smaller to make that point, okay? All right, okay, any questions, comments? No, all right, okay, good. Okay, now, again, in the Keynesian consensus, financial regulation, there was a lot of financial regulation. That's why we have, interest rate ceilings, which the neoliberal folks called financial repression, and they made them sound like they are emancipators and liberators and so on, and that nothing to do with it. But financial regulation and all kinds of regulation kept finance subordinate to production. And also social contract. There was a social contract between capital and labor, especially in the economies of the north, and that way production was responsive to the needs of the also to the reproductive sector. That is, labor workers, especially in the economies of advanced capitalist countries, were in a much better position than they are today since neoliberalism. But the unions and everybody and workers' rights have been undermined through the Washington consensus policies for very many decades now. But there was a time when labor unions, for example, were very active in the United States and effective, and they had been able to strike a kind of an understanding and accord, labor-capital accord with the capitalists, okay? But in the Keynesian consensus, what was also sort of underlying that consensus was that a lot of times workers were seen as men, so, and then the men were seen as the male breadwinners, and that's something we call the male breadwinner bias in this kind of thinking. There are many implications of that. Men were seen as the breadwinners, and of course, if you look at the history of struggles in the 19th century and early 20th century, prior to this notion of male breadwinner bias being institutionalized through bargains between labor and capital, you actually saw, of course, women also. Women have always worked in labor markets, in not as privileged positions, but they always have. But one of the things that labor unions did in the context of their struggle with capital was to argue that the men have to provide family wages. They have to get paid family wages. Nobody talked about the family wages of women who had their own children to support, who didn't have husbands, etc., or their families to support. Nobody worried about that, but it was always the family wage idea was always thought of in connection with the with men, and the notion that men would have wives and children and wives wouldn't work and so on and so forth. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that, but there is this whole history of a male breadwinner bias and male breadwinner wages, which became a part of this bargaining between capital and labor in advanced capitalist countries. But of course, women have always worked, women have always supported their families and so on, so I won't go into that. But this brought in this particular bias. And therefore, the social protection systems that were instituted under sort of these Keynesian visions of the economy were also gender biased. That is, women accessed social security through their husbands. Okay, so those are the kinds of biases that also existed in the Keynesian consensus era. And so it was a little bit, this golden age was a little bit more golden for some of our folks than other folks, right? It was like more golden for men than it was for women. But nonetheless, overall, it paid a lot more attention and prioritized much more well-being of human beings. Well-being of humans, right? And now, with the Washington Consensus, we had financial deregulation, made production became subservient to finance. And with all of this, financial calculus became primary. That is to say, there is a way to ask some things about is this economy doing well? And when I ask you, is this economy doing well, what do you think? What kind of variables come to your mind? You say employment. So from a Keynesian point of view, you would ask, for example, what is the rate of unemployment, what is employment, and so on. And what else? Work. Right. All of those. Okay. This is because you people have not been schooled sufficiently in neoliberalism. This is why you ask these questions. But if you are coming from this other kind of perspective, then to judge the health of an economy, the first and sometimes even the last thing you look at is the inflation. What's the inflation and what is the rate of growth, right? And then there might not even be a question carrying out. Is growth rate also related to the growth rate of employment? Because you can have jobless growth. But oftentimes, this is not even asked, what is the inflation rate and what is the stability? So is this an economy that is stable? And how is stability thought of in terms of the inflation rate? So there is always this financial calculus that becomes prior to understanding of human well-being. Well, you can have a very stable inflation rate, but then there can be a lot of social conflict, not enough to go around, people can be killing each other, and that is not a stable economy or a society. Neither is it going to be a stable economy. If people are killing each other over distribution because they are jobless and poor and so on and so forth, whatever, economically insecure, vulnerable, that economy is not stable economy. I am not talking about the society not being stable. That economy is not going to be stable. So this is a very strange notion of stability of the economy, right? So that's the example. So financial calculus versus understanding real human welfare. These are the things that are important. Okay, in Washington consensus, this went out the door. Market liberalization, deflationary bias. This is a bias that protects the interest of a certain class of people in the economy. As I said this, generally women do not happen to be in that class of wealth holders, right? So not only is this a kind of a class-biased sort of policy, but it is also biased against women because we do not hold or control majority of the assets in the world economy. We just do the work in the world economy, right? So it is also this deflationary bias and all this Washington bias is not only class bias, but also is a gender biased policy. All right, okay. And unresponsive to the needs of the reproduction. And labor market flexibilization. You know, this was an era where also you flexilize. We're going to talk about all of these labor standards and workers' rights and so on. But this kind of so-called flexibility of the markets, which was supposed to then clear the unemployment, because in this kind of view, you liberalize labor market and then you argue that there is unemployment because labor markets are inflexible, like these unions have come in and done too many terrible things. They are an imperfection in the labor market, and you need to say wages have to be flexible downward and they will clear the labor markets. That's the argument you make. So making labor markets flexible is supposedly the thing that will get rid of unemployment. So you don't do, your fiscal policy is not geared toward reducing unemployment, creating employment, or so and so on. Neither is your monetary policy. The way you deal with unemployment is by doing this labor market flexibilization. But of course, if you don't have enough aggregate demand, you're not going to have. The labor market is not going to clear at a wage rate that is lower than the wage that would allow people to reproduce themselves. You know what? I can always clear the labor market by having a wage rate that goes as a 10 cents an hour in the United States. Labor market would clear. Well, that would be a very, that would not, though, allow people to reproduce themselves. So there is always this question of when you do labor, any kind of supply and demand analysis, you cannot just say, oh, things are always going to clear, the markets are always going to be clear, and we're going to be really happy, because markets can clear at points where people cannot reproduce themselves, right? So anyway, all right. Okay. Now, feminist or humanist or human development view of economics, I put also human development because people are more familiar with that. The criterion is for normative kind of evaluation. There is that all economic arrangements must be assessed with a view as to whether they render both finance and production responsive to the reproductive sector and provisioning of human needs. So this has to be the primary thing, primary goal and center of the at the level of the analysis. I am going to skip some of these things. And how are these three sectors? No, I am going to skip a lot of things here because we're going to run out of time. As I said, in orthodox ways of thinking, what we do is that we look at the prices, and changes in prices is a function of excess demand and supply, and price signals work. So a lot of the mantra of the Washington Consensus was to say, you have to get the prices right. For structural adjustment and macroeconomic stabilization policies. Some of you are too young, that you were not maybe, you know, anyway. Those of us who are old enough to remember, the mantra was to get the prices right. You have to get, and if you get your prices right, then everything is going to be good. But as I said yesterday, I was arguing yesterday, all the prices in the economy are prices of discrimination, and discrimination permeates all the economy, the whole economy, the world economy. So all we have are prices of discrimination. So in that sense, prices, market prices are always wrong prices. Market prices are always wrong. There is no such thing as a right price that can emerge from the market. And when I say this to my neoclassical friends, they say, but it will go away, those are temporary. I said, no, they are not temporary. They have been here with us from time immemorial. Unless we do something about them, they are not going to go away. Yes. Even the Bible said, you know, there is the biblical rate of wages. Do you know that? In the Bible, the book of Leviathan. Women get two-thirds. Two-thirds the wages, the two-third theory of wages can release from time immemorial, as I said. So if we don't do something about it, it's not going to go away. Okay, now I'm going to skip some of my slides, how adjustments might take place in the orthodox consumption through market clearing, savings, and so forth. And that if something is not happening, then you argue there is some sort of an imperfection in the labor market and so on, and you sort of deal with that imperfection. But if you are coming from a heterodox point of view, you really don't take these slices, prices as the thing that should allocate and determine everything else at all. You say, first of all, markets do not know best. And I have an addition to that. Markets do not know best, and neither do fathers always within the household. You know, there's a saying, father knows best. In the household, father does not always know best. Well, maybe occasionally he does, but most of the time. And neither do markets. It's human beings who are thinking. The ones who know thinking human beings are required for knowledge. So in heterodox economics, you can have a lot of times perverse price effects, right? You increase the price of something and you think that there's going to be a positive supply response. It doesn't happen. It is not surprising to heterodox people, neither to feminist people in general. Responses are possible and markets are studied. You study the market, try to understand. You study the market as an institution to understand. You don't assume that people are always going to behave in this a priori given consumption that you have, right? You know, you use prices as incentives. If you increase the price, then boom, supply of something is going to go up. I'm going to give you an example of this later. But also in the alternative approaches to money and finance, in the orthodox approaches, you have this dichotomy between the real and the financial sphere or money. Money is said to be what is money?
Veil.
It's a veil, and I'm going to illustrate that by putting my shawl. It is just a veil, and therefore there is this idea of classical dichotomy. This is one of the worst dichotomies ever imagined. And when we talk about international trade as well and the notion of competitive advantage, we are going to come to this notion of classical dichotomy, because the principle of comparative advantage is itself rests on this classical dichotomy. And once we destroy this dichotomy, we will see that there is no such thing as a principle of comparative advantage. But my God, this comparative advantage has the status of what? It has the status of, among economists, it has the status of? Taboo. It is like the fourth commandment. You know, it's like the fourth commandment kind of thing. You know, the Ten Commandments is about the fourth commandment. And thou shalt believe in the principle of comparative advantage. And if you don't, you will be thrown out of the community of economists. But once you take this classical dichotomy out or destroy this notion of classical, you see that you are not, you don't have much of a principle of comparative advantage that is left. So this is very, very important for a variety of reasons, all kinds of macroeconomic thinking models and so on and so forth, and in the alternative thinking, financial, that you look at your macroeconomy, you do actually finance and real sign are seen together as interacting, and money is not neutral. And of course, do we know that now? Does everyone admit that now?
I think we've just had a terrible experience that made everybody admit that money is not neutral.
Okay, a gender example, excess demand for social protection, for example, you have structural adjustment. You have, let's say, you have a chronic balance of payments crisis, and you see that the price of tradables in terms of non-tradables is too high. So what do you do? You have to actually choke domestic demand. You deal with this by choking demand, and to do that, you cut government subsidies and expenditures in a variety of ways. So the way you are thinking through this problem is that you have a problem that manifests itself as a balance of payments problem, right? Financial variables are not working out. And then you diagnose it, and to deal with it, you cut government expenditures. And the cost of adjustment shifts actually then to the reproductive sector, and these are the people who are least prepared to deal with costs of adjustment in the context of structural adjustment policies. You see this many, many times over and over and over, and this is what is that. And what happens also is that you get a depletion of your human capabilities and weakening of the reproductive sector as the provider of last resort of social security, because it is then families, if you're cutting down social protection systems, paring them down, and so on and so forth, then anyway, women and the reproductive sector and family and households were the provider of last resort of social security. And in third world countries, they are always, it is always households and particularly women who are the providers of last resort of social security, because you don't have very advanced sort of social security systems. But what you do by doing this is you have undermining this whole thing. Not only in the currently, you are trying to do something that is of a short-term stabilization nature, but what you have actually done is undermine your capability to grow, not only undermine the well-being of people now, but you have also undermined your ability to grow in the future. So those are things that you have done. Inelastic supply of agricultural output. This is something we saw a lot in the context of structural adjustment analysis and policies. One of the things, especially in sub-Saharan African countries and a lot of other countries, were told to increase the prices of agricultural goods that could be exported. And the expectation was that once you raise these prices, there will be a positive supply response with the price signals. But it turned out that in a lot of cases, we didn't see this kind of supply response, positive supply response. And the question was, why?
Taragul.
Yes. There were very many complex, and one of the reasons that was as Gül explained, but in also in countries where you have a very gender-based division of labor between cash crops and subsistence crops, you are increasing the price of the cash crops. These may be controlled by men, but in order to increase that price, they actually have to appropriate the women's labor. They have to actually make the women work. And in many contexts, women refuse to do that because they knew that if they go and work on the lands, plots of men, that they were not going to see this return themselves. So, and a number of outcomes is possible in that context because then men can use actually violence to appropriate the labor of women. Women can give the appearance of working on the men's plots, but actually not work. And they do that a lot of times because they slow down the work. But they need to give the appearance that they are doing this work because they don't want to be subjected to violence. And one of the interesting things that we also find connected to this is that productivity of labor of women on their own plots is much higher than the productivity on men's plots, and this is obviously not accidental, because what we have here is the operation of what? Of here we have a household family, you know, the nice household family of non-gender aware people, but what we have is very much the operation of oppression, conflict, exploitation, and violence, or the threat of use of violence, because sometimes you actually don't see the violence. But if you don't see the violence, that does not mean that there isn't a psychological kind of, you may not see physical violence, but there may be psychological violence in the form of threat of violence. So women learn very quickly, I better do this, because otherwise I'm going to get physical violence. I'm going to be violated physically. So in order to avoid that, they develop ways of dealing with this psychological violence, because threatening someone to do something for you on the basis of threat of physical violence is violence. But also, this is also, in this kind of example I'm giving, it is also economic violence. So violence is not something that we necessarily can see in the beating up of women and so on. But living with the threat of violence itself is a condition of violence and a violation of the personhood of women. But these are so deep-seated, and I gave the example from, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, but please, por favor, this is all over the world. Everywhere you can see this type of example. But it got discussed quite a bit in the context of sub-Saharan Africa because this, positive supplier response was not taking in place, and people were, huh, how is this not happening? Well, that is why you study the markets. You don't take them as given or assume that they know best. You study them because markets are institutions and they are the bearers of power relations. In this case, gender-based power relations, right? So you study and you try to understand. So a policy of increasing the prices is not sufficient. You need to do a whole lot of other things, right? A whole lot of other things. But you have to understand the production system, who controls what, who owns what, and who exercises what kind of control. So in these kinds of cases, either men are able to appropriate the power, labor power of women by violence or through threat of violence, or women sort of slow down work. They work, but they don't really are not highly productive, or they outright, in the cases they were able to do so, they outright refuse to do that. And the reason that women, of course, specialize in cash crops is because women, that way, women feed their family, right, directly. Okay. Now, I really am running. I mean, I'm not running behind because I combined a number of presentations that we used to do from the past, got kind of combined into one thing. So it's not that I'm running over time in terms of what I need to cover, but I am behind. Oh, okay. Okay, because I don't really, you know, want to rush like crazy, but okay, so I have another 80 minutes. Okay, through. All right, okay. So, gender analysis and heterodox economics, emphasis on institutions, social and power relations, rather than narrowly conceived notion of market adjustments. I will not go into that. Now, gender aware, so this is the part about sort of having a feminist or gender aware vision of the economy, right? And also addressing the question, which other paradigms are we going to work with? Because, I mean, we're not inventing macroeconomics from scratch, right? It is always accumulation of knowledge. So then we also answer the question then, the types of paradigms that makes us make sense for us to rethink from a feminist or gender perspective are the heterodox paradigms, right? Okay. So that those are the two kind of basic questions that we have been addressing in our discussion. So then gender-aware macro models. Now, some people say, why bother with models? There are many different schools of thought on that, but why bother with models? So there are some feminists who don't like this idea of constructing models. Models are, you know, I am not going to go into this whole discussion, but there are people who are very skeptical, particularly some feminists who think models are useless and so on and so forth. So we at least should pose that question. And in our view, the models clarify direction and magnitude of key interactions. You are actually thinking about the key interactions yourself. You're clarifying your own head by setting up a model. And you are also, when you make a model, you realize what kind of data that you need. Because you are now asking different kinds of questions. You are constructing models that are different from other models and asking different kinds of questions. But then you also realize, I want to make an assumption here that is sort of a sensible assumption. But can I make that? Because the kind of methodology that we have is making assumptions on the basis of stylized facts, right? Not just sort of any arbitrary. But then, do we know that the assumptions are valid or not? Well, oftentimes when we are interviewing in this way in macroeconomic modeling or any kind of modeling, oftentimes because these are not the kinds of questions that have been asked before, we actually don't know for sure what the empirical regularity is or if there's a stylized fact, but the way what we rely on is really our intuition. So for example, when I tell people, I really have not measured this, but all I have seen in my life and everybody else has seen in their lives around me is that women control much fewer assets compared to men. Do you have a problem with that assumption? Yes. And what's the assumption? I mean, what's the problem? Yes. And a typical example comes and somebody says, well, you really do not have hardcore evidence on this. And I, you know what I say? Do you know what my response to you is? At this point of the conversation, I say, do you have evidence to the contrary? And then what do you say? So we're doing a little theater here. And then what do you say? You say, no, I don't. So then I say, in that case, do you think my assumption is more sensible than yours? And then you say, Yes, and then I say, this is the crux of what I'm trying to say. And then I say, until thy kingdom come and the data is collected, what are we going to do? Not think about this problem at all? Can we not touch this problem because we don't have this, you know, really data and so on? So what are we going to do? We're going to have to, convince the government of Jamaica. It's going to take us 20 years to do that. You and I are going to be dead or retired. New people may not want to take up this problem and so on. The government will change 20 times, et cetera. So what do we do? So at that point in the conversation, I will propose to you, and hopefully you will agree, I will say, I think we don't have the exact data to do this, but you know what? Why don't I just think about what our experience tells us? And the experience of all the men and women around us tell us. So let's just make a... let's take our own everyday life experiences as part of data, in a way, right? There are many different ways of... So then I would say it is probably sensible to make the assumption that women own, less than half, maybe. I don't know, we can say, we may not know the magnitudes, but we can definitely say they own less than half, okay? We can definitely say. In fact, when I make that assertion in a number of places, in a number of countries, I have said this, people have started to shake their heads. Yes, they do. And then people start telling stories. And then I say, it's not just about ownership of property and assets. I would say it's about also the control. Because even when women own legally something, they are not necessarily the ones who are controlling these assets. And that's very typical in farmland, all kinds of things like that. It may be the brother who is actually controlling or some other menfolk in the family and so on and so forth. And then people start telling a bunch of stories from different countries. Yes, my cousin, blah, 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 and so on. And I have yet to hear someone tell the opposite story of, no, actually... it really is when, even though men probably own more than half the property, it really is women who are controlling. I have yet to hear somebody make that case or tell me an example of a story. Because in general, there may be exceptions to that in individual households and even in countries and so on and so forth. But in general, people think that. So, but the point here is this. We cannot, by making models and so on and so forth, so one of the things that happens to us is that we have this kind of discussion, and then we realize what it is that really needs to be collected. But in the meantime, until that data is really collected and so on, what we can do is we can make assumptions that are of a sensible nature, and also we do not sort of, we also get into the question of, well, maybe we don't have a really sort of well-designed questionnaire, and et cetera, to collect the data and so on and so forth. But let us also use our everyday experience and observation as also data. Because just because it is me observing this thing doesn't mean that it is not valid. I mean, after all, between all 40 of us, if we're all sort of observing the same thing, probably this means something, right? Rather than just saying, oh, we don't have really scientifically designed data, so we can't really touch this point. We can say, well, let's go around the table and see what the experiences are. So make sort of sensible assumptions when we don't have the data, but also identify the need of data. Because there is always a need for understanding both quantitative data, but also qualitative assessments. So communicate with others in economics. When we make the models, especially those people for whom models, they have been trained to think in terms of models, this is very important. But also, a lot of times, policy making is based on models. For example, of computable general equilibrium models are used to run experiments and so on for policy making purposes. So you really want to be able to sort of interact with those people, but also present your own modeling to back up what you're doing. By the way, when people do those kinds of models, the non-feminist folks or non-gender aware folks, it's not like they always have the data. really, trust me, it's not like they don't, they always have this scientific data, but it's just because we think that we have to prove that we are, you know, legitimate and so on and so forth. We really have to have our data. I am not saying we should talk, you know, off the top of our head and things like that. That's not what I'm arguing. But what I am just trying to say is that when all kinds of folks make all kinds of models, trust me, they don't know the parameters a lot of times. They don't know the data either, and they make sensible assumptions. So here the point is to use common sense and try to be as, you know, commonsensical as possible. Types of models. There are simple analytical models, econometrically reduced form models, and computable kinds of models. We have examples of those in all the reading lists. But the first of all, I want to discuss the methods of bringing gender into macroeconomic modeling. And this four combination method is something I wrote about, with my colleagues Diane Elson and Karen Grohn. This is a 1995 intro. This is the introduction to the special issue of the journal World Development, 1995, November 1995. And that's where this kind of classifying ways of putting gender into macroeconomic models comes from. And that's a special issue that does have examples of some of the models that I'm going to also refer to. So there are four different methods of introducing and bringing in gender variables. One is you disaggregate existing variables by sex, okay? So you say, instead of taking a consumption, right, in the macroeconomic model, the variable C, you say, actually, consumption of men and women maybe different, right? They may have different propensities to consume, et cetera, et cetera. So you disaggregate this kind of variable. Investment might be different, whatever. But actually, this is the sort of disaggregation you also do in a number of, for example, post-Keynesian or heterodox models, right? Except there, the disaggregation behaviorally is generally in terms of the workers and capitalists, right? You always differentiate between capitalists and workers, and of course, for example, the savings behavior and the consumption behavior, and there's a famous thing that workers consume what they get, capitalists get what they invest. So there are differences in the investment or consumption or whatever, some macroeconomic variable by between men and women, you build that into the model. So that's the disaggregation method. The other one is a little bit more complicated, but it's actually behind it is a kind of a disaggregation, but we separated this into a separate method. We call it introducing a gendered variable. There can be some variable that can be influenced by gender relations. Okay, and I'm going to give you an example of that later. 5 minutes I have. And then, ta-da, you introduce the unpaid economy because you are redefining the sphere of macroeconomic analysis, right? The unpaid care economy is now becomes a part of your macroeconomic sphere of analysis because up to now, heretofore, you know, economists have only analyzed the monetized economy and they have left out all this other stuff. So, and it is not just that you are adding, you know, 1 + 2. You're not just adding these things to each other. And that's why the problem of unpaid work is not just, which is a, horribly difficult enough problem, is not about just putting some valuation. It is actually also conceptually and analytically specifying the interactions between the monetized and the non-monetized economy. That's what you do in a macroeconomic model. You specify the interactions, right? And then you see when something happens in this unpaid sphere that was visible, you see what will happen to the other sphere and vice versa. What you are doing is you are trying to specify the variety of interactions between these two spheres. That's what you're doing. or you can do what is called, what we call the combination of methods. You can be, you know, disaggregating and, you know, introducing the unpaid economy, this, that, and the other, and I'll also give you examples of combination papers we use, which do both of these things. The easiest one is that disaggregating an existing variable. Right? You know some of your style aspects, the good mother thesis, whatever it is that you know, and then boom, you take one of the variables, you disaggregate it, and then you see what the parameters are like, the differences in the parameters and so on, and then you trace that through the implications. So you can say, what happens in this model if the difference between men and women is, you know, blah? What happens in this model if I am, you know, redistributing from these people to that people, you know, whatever it is that you're doing? Distributing whatever it is, then you trace through the implications of this model. Is it clear? Claro. Sí. Sí. Muy claro. Oh, not only claro, muy claro. Gracias. Gracias. Muchas gracias. Disaggregate existing variables by sex. I am going to skip this, but I just want to say that this is consistent with gender as a characteristic of individuals, not as a system of social power, though. Because what you're doing is that, you are putting a gender variable to each person with a different kind of behavioral characteristics. I am not putting this method down. I do this myself, but you have to explain why you are disaggregating. What is behind this notion of disaggregation? Why are you doing this? And how this is actually a reflection of a social system of power relations and so on, okay? Now, this is consistent, this can be consistent with the representative agent microfoundations of macroeconomics. It can be, but as I was emphasizing at the very, 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 very beginning, just because this looks like it can be consistent with the representative agent model does not mean that this kind of model is going to be actually a feminist model. Right? It is not. So these are sort of things that we really have to be careful about. And also, it can be interpreted as consistent with post-Keynesian approaches, where the gender characteristics are interpreted socially. So what matters is that the interpretations you give, right? And in post-Keynesian models, these are kind of similar to, you know, variables that are introducing class-based variables, and there is a whole social interpretation of social relations behind those variables. What you see in the model is just a, you know, little variable, but there is a whole history of thinking behind why those variables are important. Now, the second method is introducing gendered variables. You recognize the parameters of the model as potentially variable bearers of gender. There is an example of this that Diane Elson describes in her paper in the November 1995 issue, and I don't have time to do that. There is another example of a paper that does this in a paper I co-authored in 1995. That's again in the special issue, where investment is a function of the degree of feminization of employment. Okay, so we take the variable investment and then make investment a function of not only of the interest rate, but investment becomes also a function of the feminization of employment in the economy. And there is a reason for that, because the more in some ways, the more feminized the economy becomes because of those discriminatory waging pricing system that we have, the higher is going to be the rate of, if you're familiar with Marxist economics, the higher is going to be the potential rate of exploitation of workers, right? You know, if I had an economy where women were only doing unpaid work and men were doing only paid work, we would have a perfectly gender segregated economy, right? But then, so the rate of exploitation in the paid economy would not be influenced by wage discrimination because women are not at all a part of the monetized labor, part of the labor market, right? And as I bring them into the economy, what am I doing? I'm actually increasing the, slowly increasing the potentially the rate of exploitation in the economy. If I had an economy that was made up of 100% of women workers, who would, and I reversed them, I put all the men in the unpaid sphere, I would have the potential to lower all the wages. Let's say there is a 30% discrimination, right? I would actually be lowering of the wages if I switch the men and the women around, right? What have I done? I have increased potentially. This is controlling for wages and of skills and so on. So when I'm talking about discrimination, this is controlling for wages, productivity, and da 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 da, right? What have I done? I have increased the rate of exploitation, potential profitability in the economy, and therefore I could have an impact on, this could be having an impact on investment. So I'm just trying to explain the intuition of how this kind of works, okay? So then you work through the, you know, analysis, you take this. Yeah, no. I am just sort of trying to illustrate an example where I take two extreme cases of perfectly gender segregated economies and then I switch them. Because actually, you know, if women are cheaper workers, why aren't they the ones who are working? Why does anybody hire a man at all? Right? Okay, so there are reasons why that happens, but we'll get back to that. But I'm just trying to give these hypothetical extreme case examples to illustrate the point why the degree of feminization of employment may have an influence on the rate of investment. And in fact, actually, when you look at specific sectors, export sectors, apparel, et cetera, you will see that this is a variable in those kinds of specific sectors. You will see that it plays a role. So that's, I was just trying to give extreme examples. Okay, now, so then there is another paper by Stephanie Sacchino in World Development, July 2002. She introduces the gender wage gap into an accounting for growth model for a group of semi-industrialized countries, and what she finds is that high growth rates are associated with high gender wage gaps. This is like the same kind of intuition that in the 1995 model, what we were saying that by the capitalists can really increase the rate of exploitation and profitability by the degree of feminization. So there is a way in which they do benefit from that. So in the 1995 model, we, you know, took that and made that a part of the model, but we were doing all kinds of other things in this model. In Sacchino's model, Sacchino shows that the high growth rates are associated with high gender wage gaps. We'll explain the logic of this in when we're actually also doing trade, a feminist session. We're going to do feminist approaches to trade because it's an open economy thing. Now, the third type of approach is to add two sectors. As I was saying before, you have the monetized sector, the normal macroeconomy, and then you bring in the abnormal abnormal part of the macroeconomy, which is the unpaid reproductive sector, and you trace the variables. And actually, in the previous model that I mentioned that I had co-authored myself, this is a model that does this gendered variable. It does gender desegregation, and then it also does this two-sector thing. So that model, I just say, it does a lot of these things at the same time. But there is an interesting model by Lance Taylor in World Development, November 1995, special issue. Lance Taylor, you might Some of you might know him. And actually what he did in his approach was, the paper is called Gender and Environmental Feedbacks in Macroeconomics. And this is a very interesting model in my view, and it's a model that really needs to be go back and visited and revisited and actually rethought, and its relevance must be rethought. Some of you may look at that model as well. So this is a model where there are there's a vector of non-monetary gender equality variables that are interacting with a vector of monetary macroeconomic variables. The gender equality variables can also be sort of a sort of environmental variables. So that's why the model is called Gender and Environmental Feedbacks in Macroeconomics. And this would be interesting to see the interactions of all of those. Anyhow, Lance Taylor has a model like that. Gender equality variables could include per capita women's year of schooling, women's labor force participation rate versus men's, etc. And then model analyzes negative and positive feedbacks between the two sectors. So it's like you have two sectors here. This one is the normal, quote unquote, normal macroeconomy, and I have this other kind of sector. The monetized macroeconomy may have variables that might be faster changing variables, and these sector, this other vector may have variables. These variables might be more slowly changing kinds of variables. For example, you know, years of schooling and so on, these do not change so fast. Whereas, you know, the other kinds of variables in the, that we have in macroeconomy might be changing very fast. But we can just specify the interactions and then see what kinds of feedbacks. When something happens from this side, what happens to the other side of the model and vice versa. And you can look at cumulative causation, all kinds of things. So very, very interesting model in my view. And you can add an unpaid domestic care work sector producing labor for the monetized economy, say, shaped by social norms rather than by money. And again, the paper that I just was mentioning in terms of investment being a function of feminization, it's the same paper. And but in this paper, there's also an unpaid domestic care work. So there are two sectors, again, in this paper. And then for sort of completion, we say you can do a combination of these methods. So in short, when we are doing macroeconomic modeling and implications of gender linkages, what we do is we start with stylized facts, but this is a heterodox methodology. Anyway, you always start with stylized facts or reasonable conjectures about reality, and you take your mega themes. There are certain mega themes that we always working with. These mega themes might be things like female workers as the preferred labor supply because they are maybe cheap and docile, for example, right? And link that to the rate of exploitation, to the rate of profitability. You might think of the reproductive economy as a kind of a subsidy to the monetized economy. You might think of the reproductive economy as a source of market expenditure, etc. So there are certain mega themes. These are the mega themes that we are work with. Now, I was going to give then the example of this paper that I had been talking about, because the example of the interesting thing about this example of paper by myself and Korkut Ertürk is that it is not only an example of a model that has, you know, gendered variables, does desegregation, and has the actually both the monetized and the non-monetized care economy. But actually, this paper was also about changes in feminization of employment, and it was looking at cyclicality as well as secular changes. So, and of course, now what we are doing is we are all looking at crisis and cyclicality, and this was an analytical way of looking at cyclicality and the impact of changes in feminization of employment on the behavior of the macro economy. So that's what this was doing. So it is somewhat, the content of it is somewhat relevant. It's not somewhat, it is relevant to the analysis of the current situation, but I've run out of time, so I'm not going to do that. But there is a female there is a stylized fact that is an empirical finding that says there's a feminization U, right? That incomes in countries as at the sort of if you're a low-income economy, you will actually have a high female share of employment. The share of employment, for a variety of reasons, falls. When you're a mid-income economy, they have the lowest share. Women have the lowest share, and then this increases. And then you take this feminization U, and then you incorporate it in your macroeconomic model, and then you see how the outcomes can be different and what they can tell you, especially with regard to cyclicality and crisis situations. So the model, that model is also a model that addresses cyclicality. And actually, someone who will be joining us later has been also taking that model as an inspiration and looking at some empirical data, looking at she looked at all the recessions in Turkey, recessions and crises in Turkey since 1986 to the present, looking at them from this kind of lens of a gender-aware macroeconomic lens. Okay, so I am going to skip all of this, and I just already said that there are combination of models. There are also, of course, computable general equilibrium models which have gender variables and in them. We will see later some examples of those. In these kinds of models, you calibrate the model with data. This particular one of Fontana calibrates the model with data from Bangladesh and simulates effects of policy changes and so on some of the outcomes. And these are some of the findings of this paper. And I want us to have maybe 2 minutes and then I'm going to finish. There are, in a paper that I wrote with Diane Alston in 2002 in the special issue of World Development, we wrote a paper called the Social, Social Content of Macroeconomics. And from a gender point of view, at that point in time, we were emphasizing three things that have real relevance for the social content, and I don't have time to explain the concept of social content of macroeconomics tonight. I don't have time to go to that. But we were saying that in the world economy, what we saw was a deflationary bias, which had a class bias, but from our point of view, it was also gender bias for reasons that I explained before. And we also said that macroeconomic regimes operate on the basis of the male breadwinner bias. And we also said that there was a bias toward commodification and privatization, especially in the era of the Washington Consensus. And we talked about some of the implications of these kinds of types of biases. So these are the kinds of biases we would identify in some ways at a kind of much more at a mega level, meta level, and so on, and then trace the implications of these for the social content of macroeconomics. These are some things that I'm going to skip, and we are going to ask what kind of macroeconomic models, and then finish with this notion of how useful are models in policy advocacy. This is a question that we always have to think about, answer, and so on. Thank you very much. I apologize for going over time, but this, again, as I said, was condensed a number of presentations we used to do, because this year we have more stuff on the crisis. So anyhow, I am going to finish here. And I don't think we have any time for questions, but I'm happy to stay in the room and answer questions. For those of you who have questions, I'm happy to stay in the room and answer them.